Welcome to Torah Timecha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Liat Meyerfeld, and today we are learning Menachim Aleph, Chapter 6. A classic Jewish joke describes a policeman walking past a man swimming in dangerous waters. "Hey, don't you see the no swimming allowed sign?" The man is flabbergasted. "I'm not sure what you mean, officer. All I could see was the sign, no swimming allowed." There are, of course, different ways to read the same text. The question of how to read chapter 6 is not a question of content, but a question of melody. The chapter can be read as a professional report by architects detailing technical needs and dimensions. Certainly, at first glance, the chapter appears to be a specification of dimensions and building materials. But at second glance, we can't help but notice that the chapter before us is a love song for the temple, wanting not to miss a single element of its details. We must read it as a love song full of admiration. Imagine a person who, after years of construction, these things always seem to take longer than we plan, and he's now entered his new home. He stands and stares in wonder and shows it to you. Here is the bathroom, with a deep sink and the color-coordinated everything, and in the children's room the bed faces the window, and the bright mirror on the wardrobe door, and did you notice my... This chapter was clearly written with that type of intense love. We start with a declaration of the date. "Hear ye, hear ye. On this date a historical event has happened. It's majestic, exciting. 480 years after the Exodus from Egypt, which is the fourth year of Shlomo's reign, the house of Hashem was founded. 7 years later, its construction was completed." 480 years is exactly 12 generations, and it took 7 years. Mathematical perfection in biblical terms. And it's described as after the Exodus of Egypt. The temple constitutes a watershed in Jewish history. If the Exodus is the birth of our nation, its formative period, then the building of the temple reflects a point at which Israel is robust and independent, having reached a mature state of adulthood. This is the climax of our freedom. When reading these technical details, we're invited to be part of an experience, an all senses included awesome experience of connection. The visions are described. The chapter provides the technical specification of the temple structure, its dimensions, the raw materials from which it was made, and even the form of the decorations with which it was decorated. The house was built of whole stone, then cedarwood paneling and hardwood cypress flooring, and lots of gold to coat the wood. There are technical terms, which were probably understandable to the professionals of the generation, but challenging to later interpreters. For example, the windows are described as shkufim atumim, transparently opaque. Could they be both? Were they perhaps photo gray? A picture of a three-part structure emerges, an external courtyard, then an entrance area, heichal, where the altar is located, and an internal space, dvir, where the ark will be placed, anet kruvim. Their description is clearly a stanza of a love song, the kruvim, winged figures, apparently human, that are placed on the ark. The poem calculates for us the wingspan of each of them, 10 cubits from the tip of its wings to the tips of his wings. And even though we know it, it also informs us the length of each wing separately, being 5 cubits. After they are made from cedar wood, they stand side by side, and together they fill the entire width of the space. Each of them touches one of their wings to the wall next to them. And the final line, as if anticipating and gilding the poem as well, they were covered, the kruvim, with gold. And the sounds, when the house was built, only finished stones cut at the quarry were used, so that no hammer or axe or any iron tool was heard in the house while it was being built. No sounds were heard in the house while it was being built. No house sounds of hammers, axes, or any iron tool. Those are materials that could be used for warfare and killing. The Beit HaMikdash will bring atonement for this and all sins. So we were already commanded in the Book of Devarim that the stones must be brought prepared to the Temple Mount. No loud tools are used. Imagine a building site where all that is heard is the quiet hum of people peacefully working in unison. According to some, this was accomplished by hewing the stone elsewhere and bringing its size to the temple location. According to others, this was accomplished miraculously by use of the shamir. The Talmud indicates that stone could be split by merely showing it to the shamir, suggesting that it was an animate being. Rashi and the Rambam explain that the shamir was a stone-cutting worm. According to the Mishnah, Avot chapter 5, the shamir was one of those extraordinary things that were created at the last moment of the 6 days of creation to be held in reserve for when they would be needed later. Midrash Tehilim adds that the shamir was brought to Shlomo from the Garden of Eden by an eagle or by a hoopoe. The Talmud has an extensive explanation of how King Shlomo obtained the elusive shamir by commanding Ashmedai, king of the demons. He used it by the same methods that Moshe had the shamir cut the stones for the Kohen's ephod. and after he made use of the shamil to cut the stone needed to build the temple, it's recorded as having disappeared from our world. Verse after verse of stone, cedars, copper, and gold, the work of building a house of Hashem. Details of details that add up to a huge and very expensive monument. Finally, there is stability. There is assurance that this is it. God has a house you don't leave. But this is a false sense of security. All this poetry cannot obscure the fact that its destruction is contained in the chapters of its construction, as if the foundations themselves stand on a shaky foundation of the fickle human soul. Within the detailed description of the physical temple, there's a break. It's almost like Yirmiyahu can't help himself in the middle. Hashem speaks to Shlomo. We would have expected a word of thanks and appreciation, recognition of the effort invested, chazak ve'ematz maybe, shkoyach. Let's see the words. Hashem speaks to King Shlomo, verse 12 and 13. הבית הזה אשר אתה בונה, אם תלך בחוקותיי ואת משפטיי תעשה, ושמרת את כל מצוותיי ללכת בהם, והקימותי את דבריי איתך אשר דיברתי אל דוד אביך. With regard to this house you are building, if you follow my laws and observe my rules and faithfully keep my commandments, I will fulfill for you the promise that I gave to your father David. ושכנתי בתוך בני ישראל ולא אעזוב את עמי ישראל. I will dwell amongst the children of Israel and I will never forsake my people Israel. We are stopped in the most intense moment, in the middle of the poem. Hashem stops Shlomo and asks, "Do you really mean it?" You hear these verses, stopped in our tracks. What is he saying? Is this appreciation or warning? When we look carefully at the verse before and after, we see usage of the word vayechalehu, he has finished. Similarly to when Hashem finished creation, vayechulu hashamayim ve'aretz, a sense of completion and wholeness. Shlomo is trying to show that the building of the Mikdash is a reflection of the creation of the world, that the Mikdash is a reflection of Hashem. But Hashem, in essence, says, you're playing dangerously. Are you really trying to reflect me? You're building a temple I didn't ask for. You're building a temple that will be physical. What are you trying to accomplish? Originally, in Parashat Terumah, Hashem had said, build for me a Mikdash and I will dwell within them. When I asked, says Hashem, is for you to build a physical space, but it will be kadosh, separate from politics, separate from materialism. Mikdash kadosh is separateness, different. In your lives, something that is elevated, differentiated. For the soul to rest in a body, it needs space. In the Mishkan and the Ark, we're kruvim facing each other with no extra space, and Hashem says, I will be between the wings, space where there is no space, like a soul in our bodies. Creating a space that is not physical, on the Ark, between the kruvim, the conceptual. Hashem says, Vasu li mikdash. Kedusha is the space beyond the physical. And now let's look here at our chapter. The word kadosh isn't mentioned even once. Shlomo is building a bayit, a house for Hashem, a house for the king, a house for the daughter of Pharaoh. Shlomo is building houses, but not a mikdash. Shlomo's consciousness is dangerous. He wants to build a house for Hashem, but it is of this earth, earthly. And we experience here what we will see throughout history, the continuous question, does Hashem dominate the house, or does the house try to dominate Hashem? Who is the master here? So we have these verses. After we hear, bayit, 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 house, 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 Hashem stops and asks, this house that you're building, a house for who? There's a condition. It's only worthwhile if it's for my commandments, my rules and laws. There's more to the sustainability of God's house than the physical structure. The strongest physical edifice can collapse like straw, along with its function as a focal point for God's presence amongst his people, if those spiritual conditions aren't met. But ultimately, where do I rest? V'shachanti b'toch b'nei Yisrael. I will dwell amongst them. If the focus is kadosh, then I am within the people. I didn't ask for a house, says Hashem. I asked for kedusha, for holiness, spiritual and the physical, a soul within the materialism. Beware of the pull of materialism. Beware of losing focus. You are building a house, but I want a space that isn't a house. I want to be within the people. If you are careful to build it as I wish, if you are aware of the dangers of your power, then your reign can be complete with my eternal kedusha. And we see the continuation of the building. He builds and builds, still building a house. For example, the kruvim that we discussed. In the Mishkan, kruvim are the first thing to be discussed. It's clearly the focus. Kruvim on the ark with wings up and facing each other, and Hashem rests between them. And in our chapter, verse 23, Shlomo builds huge kruvim, and the verses repeat the size a few times, telling us how huge they are, touching the walls till the ceiling. They fill the dvir completely. The ark isn't even there yet. It's only brought later after King Shlomo's own palace is finished. When it's brought, we will see that these kruvim will cover and basically hide the ark and the original kruvim on it. I don't understand Kabbalah at all, but there is a concept of a chariot for Hashem's presence, Merkava l'Shechina. We create a place for Hashem to rest, a physical place for Hashem's spiritual essence. The entire Mishkan was this, specifically the ark, the Aron with the kruvim on it. It's the pinnacle of the spiritual. But in Shlomo's temple, the message to Hashem is different. Not that we want Hashem to rest on the ark, the place of the Torah. We want you to rest in a house that we built. These big kruvim will be the place for the Shechina. It's almost a political statement of King Shlomo, a show of control as a country of Israel with huge capabilities, a country first, with godliness in it second. Beyond all the beauty and architecture that King Shlomo builds, beyond this is a philosophical, political message of power. Despite this, we look positively at Shlomo's actions. We can recognize all the efforts put in. Shlomo is committed to build a house of Hashem. Perhaps the political message is so subconscious he doesn't even realize it yet. And we see that despite the prophecy, despite the hint that the structure into which he was devoting so many resources would not last forever, his enthusiasm for the project continued unabated. The uncertainty of the future, even the certainty that a good thing will come to an end, does not erase the value of one's wholehearted efforts in the present. Thank you for studying together, Lilui Neshamot Imotenu Yekarot, Esther Oppenheimer Alei Shalom, and Sarah Schenker Alei Shalom, each deeply devoted and proud to transmit their family's Torah legacy to the next generations.